Okay. Let's call the meeting back to order. We'll move into the item number 14, commission work session. This has been put off for a couple meetings. This was something we'd hoped to have in January of this year to welcome the new commissioners who've joined the commission and to give them some information about what it is they are supposed to do here on the Fish and Wildlife Commission, and most importantly, the laws that we have to operate within. So we have before us Bill Freymeyer, Assistant AG, who has ably given us advice throughout, and it's just a real terrific boon to the commission to have an Assistant AG with us all the time to keep us on the straight and narrow. Because I've seen some decision-making bodies that don't have that service provided, and they struggle quite a bit. And it's there's been a number of times that Bill has just jumped in and saved us from our inexperience with the rules. Never have any bad intent, but just need some coaching sometimes. So this is an orientation session, but I think it's always a good idea for commissioners who've been on the commission for a long time to be reminded of the rules, some of the laws, and remind us what we're here to do, the grant, the authorities given us by the people. So with that, welcome, Bill. Thanks for helping us.
Thank you, Chair, and good morning, members of the Commission, Director and Deputy Director. I will, because you have the opportunity to catch me at any of the future meetings and my boss, I'll be relatively brief in this. I'm happy to answer questions, but to the extent, you know, we want to talk about things later, that's fine also. So I intend to talk about, give you an overview of procedural laws and substantive laws that apply particularly to the Commission. And this begins with basic civics and the three branches of government provided by the Constitution. You remember that it's the legislative, it's the executive, and the judicial. And hopefully if we talk about the legislative and executive today and follow what that guidance is, we don't deal with the judicial very often. So the legislature passes laws, and those laws, you know, they are laws of it's chapter so-and-so, laws of 2011, stuff like that. The code reviser takes those laws and organizes them in a thing called the Revised Code of Washington. And so so your statutes are in RCWs, and so we often talk about RCW 77 something or other. It is a law passed by the legislature and then converted by the code reviser into an RCW. So if you looked at a law as it gets passed by the legislature, signed by the governor, it doesn't have an RCW number on it necessarily. Code reviser takes those and puts those into the code. The commission and the department as a whole, almost all state agencies, are creatures of the legislature. The legislature creates them by statute. Only agencies or entities that are recognized in the Constitution are separate. So most agencies are created by legislative action. And looking really quickly at the history of the Department of the Natural Resource Agency that deals with fish and wildlife, we can see the legislature's made some fundamental changes over the years. From 1933 to 1987, there were two state agencies that dealt with fish and wildlife issues, Department of Fisheries, and their code was in RCW 75. So all of the 75 statutes, which we rarely see anymore, applied to the Department of Fisheries, and they dealt primarily with food fish and shellfish issues. And at the same time, the Department of Game dealt with all the terrestrial creatures and a thing called game fish. And so there was some overlap, but there were two state agencies that dealt with these resources. In 1987, the legislature made fundamental changes to the Department of Game, and turned it into the Department of Wildlife, changed its authorities to some extent, expanded authorities, expanded some funding sources, and created the Department of Wildlife. In 1994, the legislature merged the Department of Fisheries with the Department of Wildlife to create what we have today, the Department of Fish and Wildlife. In 1995, the legislature again took some action to adjust the they made a number of editorial changes throughout the code, but it also was a place where they had made a change to the governor's appointment authority to get it back to a prior version, which we have today, where the governor appoints the commission and the commission selects the director. So those just steps show that the legislature can change fundamental characteristics of agencies. So we're going to be talking about statutes. That's the legislative direction to you, what it is you do. Agencies have only the express authority provided by statute or the Constitution, and that authority necessarily implied to implement that express authority. The commission can take that authority, and then it can further clarify or it can't expand the authority, but it can implement those authorities through the adoption of rules. And rules are necessarily dependent on that fundamental statutory authority. So the commission couldn't adopt a rule about something it has no statutory authority for, or we couldn't find any that would support it. So we're going to talk mainly about procedural laws. These are the how you do things, and then we'll talk just briefly about the what it is you do. But the how things are the Open Public Meetings Act, the Administrative Procedure Act, Public Records Act I'm going to touch on real briefly, and then at the very end of the thing, I'm going to talk about the Ethics in Public Service Act, because that applies to you in a little different way than these other laws. But looking at the first three, we'll talk about these are how you do things and things you need to follow in order to get your substantive work done. So starting with the Open Public Meetings Act, it has a statute that's it's in the RCW 42 title, and so these procedural things are sort of spread in different places. Not all of the statutes that apply to you are in Title 77. So there's statutes all throughout the code that you use. And in the legislative declaration, this is sort of the overarching statement about the Open Public Meetings Act. It talks about commissions and boards and state agencies do the people's business, and it talks about how the people, the citizens of the state, all the people of the state, do not yield their sovereignty to agencies, but that those agencies serve the people. And it ends up with statements that actions and deliberations of those government bodies that are doing the people's business need to be taken openly. So this is the overarching gloss about how this chapter is to be read. It goes on to say, to specify that the Open Public Meetings Act applies to multi-member bodies. So it doesn't apply to the director. The director is subject to a number of other laws, but if the director was to take an action, the director doesn't need to have an open public meeting to do it. The point is just different. They're just fundamentally different situations. So the Open Public Meetings Act applies to multi-member boards and commissions. In general, it requires prior notice of your meetings, and it requires public access to your meetings. The public has to be able to see your business. It does not require that you hear from the public. So there may be some other statutory requirements in the business you do that require you to hold a hearing or take public comment, and nothing prevents you from allowing public comment. But the Open Public Meetings Act by itself doesn't require that you hear from the public. It just forces you to transact your business in view of the public. And given that legislative declaration, courts interpret those things very, very broadly. So the Open Public Meetings Act applies to what's called a governing body, and there's a specific definition of that, but you, the nine of you together, are a governing body. And whenever a quorum of you, and a quorum for you is defined by statute. And so it says whenever five or more of you meet together to transact the business of the Department of Fish and Wildlife, then you are generally, almost always, required to meet in public. If less than a quorum of you meet, there are certain circumstances required by the Act that the Open Public Meetings Act part would follow along. So if the body as a whole delegated some duty to a small group and said, you can make, we're empowering you to make this, to look at this and undertake an examination of it, if that group had authority to actually do something, then it would have the authority of the commission as a whole to do it, and the Open Public Meetings Act, open meetings part, would travel with that. Now, you don't do that very often, and I think that's a good thing, but it's just something to think about. If a group less than a quorum met to didn't have authority, but just had the authority to make recommendations back to the body as a whole, then the Open Public Meetings Act would not necessarily apply. So your committees are meetings of less than a quorum, and you do not necessarily have to have them as open public meetings because the committee is not empowered to do anything. If five members came to a committee meeting, you'd have a quorum, and then you're back to the Act. So whenever you have five or more, doing the business of the department, you need to have an open public meeting. In the committee structure, nothing prevents you from having an open public meeting. So you're not required to not have one, but you just don't necessarily have to.
Any questions? Commissioner Jennings?
So a key part of it seems to be doing business to define the quorum. Because I know in the past, for example, when we've had a large public function up in Seattle, we've been very careful not to have more than four commissioners go to it. But that to me didn't seem like a setting where we would be doing commission business. So is there some sort of a delineation between five of us getting together to do business and five of us getting together? Or is it the concern that we would be having an offline discussion or something?
Two things. The legal concern is if five of you or more are together talking about the business of the state, then it's a legal requirement you meet in open public session. You announce that meeting ahead of time, provide notice of where it's going to be under the rules, and that you meet in public if you're doing the business of the department. So if you all meet together on a plane to fly over to this meeting and you talk about the Mariners, you know, then even though there could be six of you, if you choose to talk about the Mariners, you know, then you are not transacting the business of the department and you wouldn't necessarily need to have a public meeting. So when you're in places, you know, where there's a quorum of you or more and you can't have a public meeting, don't talk about the business of the government. A different circumstance, and the Attorney General's office wrote an official opinion about this, was if there was a big conference in Seattle about the future of fisheries, and seven of you were just really interested in it, and you're sprinkled throughout the auditorium, the fact that seven of you are there hearing presentations about the future of fisheries, if you're not, you know, together, and you're not, you know, actually working together to do the business, but you're in the same room and hearing the subject, I think that is different. So I don't think you need public notice about that. But if you want to get together and talk about what we've heard, then you'd need to do that.
I think Commissioner Schmitten was next.
I want to pick up on this, too. I've struggled for a long time between the a rigorous view of the Open Public Meetings Act and the other side of it, the need for informal commission discussion among themselves. And for example, Bill, let's boil down a little further. Three members of the commission want to go to lunch, sit down. They're not empowered or authorized for any decision making. Is there any reason we couldn't discuss business? The Act doesn't, does it prohibit it?
No, the Act, three of you, no, if it's less than five, then three of you can talk about the business. You can't take action of the commission. The other thing, though, to think about is there's the legal test and there's also the public view sort of test, the newspaper test. And so you want to be, you know, the Act is all about you doing the important business of the state in front of the public, and so you want to be cognizant of, you know, how interested the public may be about your thing. So,
okay. Commissioner Carpenter?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bill, two questions or two. What if we were invited individually or perhaps even as a group to a reception that had nothing to do with fish and wildlife business, A, and I think Commissioner Mangan has a birthday coming up soon, and we were wanting to celebrate, have some type of a social function on behalf of his birthday. How does that match up with the open public meeting process?
I think you would think about that in two ways. One, if you all get together and celebrate his birthday and don't talk about the business of the commission, then legally, you don't talk at all about the business of the, you know, department, then legally, you know, you are not transacting the business of the department, so it is not, it would not be a meeting of the commission. It would be a meeting of the nine people who know it's his birthday, and so you're meeting in a different context. So it would not trigger the Act. However, you know, that's the legal part. The other part is the perception part. So it's going to be the where, the how, the sort of, you know, all that is something to think about.
Don't bring any gifts, by the way.
No gifts? He's requesting no gifts.
So the general rule about your meetings are they are to be done in public with prior notice. There are narrow exceptions, and I'm not sure whether the two newest members have seen them, but you can have a meeting in which you can exclude the public under certain very narrow reasons. And one of them is to receive certain types of legal advice from the Attorney General's office. There are some, it can't be about every legal subject you're interested in, but in certain circumstances, we can provide advice to you and answer questions, you know, for you in what's called an executive session. There are rules about how we need to set that up and the relationship, but there are certain times in which you can have a confidential discussion with your lawyers. There are times where you can review the performance of your staff, of the director, of your executive assistant, and there are certain times in which you can do that in executive session. There are also some rules about things related to those things that you then need to do in open session. So, for instance, if you were to change a salary decision, the final decision has to be done in the open. So there are some narrow deals, but a court would view those very, very strictly because of the broad, you know, spirit and the legislative direction about the importance of openness.
Okay. Commissioner Duvia?
Thanks, Madam Chair. If we wanted to have a retreat for education and open discussion, non-decision-making, is that possible?
Yes, it is. It would be, though, need to comply with the Open Public Meetings Act. I don't believe that any of the exceptions that would create an executive session would reach to a retreat. So you can have a work, you can have a work session or retreat, but and other agencies do that, local governments do that, but it needs to have notice and be open. And you've done that in the past.
Yes, we have. Commissioner Caney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Similarly, a tour. So I think there's a tour being planned for Okanagan County to look at some of the properties that have been acquired by the Department of Wildlife. And I would assume most of the commissioners would be there. Does that then fall under open? You're definitely talking about the business of the state. So is that open for the public, Open Meetings Act, and then is public invited to attend that tour and go along? Or
yeah, tours can be difficult. And If it is a tour organized by the department for you, you know, that is, to me, the most clear example of, okay, how are we going to comply with the Open Public Meetings Act? And you've done that in the past. We've said you're going to go on a tour. We've made provisions to, you know, tell people, here's where we're going to go. Bring your car. Get in line. We'll stop. Everybody gathers. But the public comes along as best you can. That's why tours are very difficult. If it's a tour proposed by somebody else and five or more of you want to go, if you're going to sit together and talk about the business of the department, you know, how this, look at this great salmon habitat, this project, I mean, and your subject matter is really broad in natural resources, then I think you're going to need to decide, you know, if we're going to talk together, then Open Public Meetings Act, how are we going to comply with that? If it's a big enough tour that, you know, there's 60 cars and one of you is in number 3, number 7, 25, and blah, 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 and you don't talk together, you know, and it's then it's a different circumstance. So the other thing about this is you set up conference calls, and we make provision to provide access to the public by having a publicly available place that the public can hear your conference calls. So when conference calls first came up, how are we going to, you know, provide that opportunity for the public to hear or see you? The other part about this is emails and telephone calls. There are some court cases that say if there's a chain email in which one person sends it to another and then you forward it around, you end up with this, you're not all discussing something together in time, but it's a sequential thing, and that has been found to be a meeting. So these reply all opportunities, you need to think about being very careful. One commissioner can send information to the rest of you, the director can send information to all of you, but it's when you get into a discussion of it through email or telephone that it potentially triggers the Open Public Meetings Act, because if a quorum or more of you are talking about the business of the department, then that meets the standard. So
in the way we always handle it to make it very clean is to send anything we want distributed to the full commission to Tammy. And Tammy's the one that distributes information. So we don't have to try to draw that bright line between just sending out information and getting into a dialogue. Everything just goes to the commission office, and then it is circulated as any piece of information is.
Couple different last little bits about the Open Public Meetings
Act. Commissioner Perry has a question. Oh. And then,
yeah. Excuse me, Bill, but if you're going to get into this later, I'll wait till later. But how does this apply to public records? you talked about emails and maybe phone logs, that sort of stuff. How does it apply to that?
Well, I will talk briefly about the Public Records Act, and we will probably come back at another time and give you a more detailed discussion about public records and the record retention system and how that all works.
That's fine.
But I will get into it in a minute.
Commissioner Jennings?
Just to follow up on the email process we use, because I think there's a little bit of a distinction in my mind rather than what you said. When we want to send something out to all the commissioners, we send it to the commission office, they distribute it. That does two things. One, it gets us on the record, so if somebody else is asking about the trail, it's there. But if somebody responds back to that email, sends it to Tammy, and sends it back out, to me, that's actually still an email chain. And so it's, even though we're going through the commission office, that doesn't break the conversation that the court case was worried about. And that's my internal interpretation, but...
Well, and it may be one, if we want to talk about that in greater detail, that may be something we you know, continue to talk about over time. But
and let me just be clear. I don't think we've done that. I mean, I think it's really a one-way distribution. I'm just saying, in my mind, that's a caution where if we start responding back and forth to those, that might be worthy of further conversation.
Under the Open Public Meetings Act, there are two types of meetings you have, and you don't normally, this doesn't really apply to your business, but we think about it and the director thinks about it. Regular meetings are ones in which you announce it way ahead of time, and when we know those meetings, you know, you set your schedule in the fall or whatever for the next meeting. We're able to take that schedule and file it with the code revisor, and then those meetings become what's called a regular meeting. And a regular meeting is, because it's noticed through the code revisor process, it becomes an open meeting. So, for instance, today's a regular meeting, and if a new agenda item came up, you can go ahead and deal with it right today. We don't need any extra. So the agenda is open on a regular meeting. And so your main two-day meetings through the calendar year and your conference calls are, for the most part, regular meetings, and so they're open agenda. If something comes up, there's another provision that says, well, if a need for a meeting comes up beyond sort of your calendared ones from the fall, you can have a meeting with as little as 24-hour notice. The more notice you provide of this new meeting, the better, but you have to provide at least 24-hour notice. And the Act tells you who you have to give this notice to. Those, what's called special meetings, are limited to the agenda that you send out announcing the meeting. So in order to get that 24-hour notice out, whatever's in that agenda, you know, you are limited to dealing with that. So those are, you know, single issue or one issue things. So you have had periodically joint meetings with the State of Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission, and when we set those up, they have their Open Public Meetings Act law, you have yours, and so we anticipate the problems and work together behind the scenes seamlessly to make sure that both laws are complied with and you can do it. Meetings with tribes. You as a commission have had some meetings with the Puget Sound tribes or tribes throughout the state. And sometimes there are some issues about that because the tribal governments don't necessarily have an Open Public Meetings Act, and sometimes they would rather meet with the whole body outside the view of the public. And so we work with that and generally, you know, say you are subject to the Open Public Meetings Act, and that, you know, we just have to do it that way. Your meeting with the governor is the same thing. We announce those as Open Public Meetings Act and go with that. So that sort of concludes the Open Public Meetings Act. Now it's going to go on to the Administrative Procedures Act. So it does two things. This is really a set of rules about how two things get done. And you do one of them. It provides a bunch of rules and processes about the adoption of rules. And rules are your ability to clarify your statutory authority out to your constituents or publics or, you know, provide information about how things happen. The other big thing that the Administrative Procedures Act provides structure for is the holding of adjudicative hearings. We don't have any hearings that come before you. Other boards do have individual hearings about the granting or the withdrawal or denial of benefits or a penalty, something like that. The department does a number of administrative adjudicative hearings, and they need to follow those rules. And so for instance, HPA permit denials or challenges, all that needs to follow those rules. So in the rulemaking side, we'll just go briefly. In your packets, to adopt a rule, there is a long timeline of things that need to happen. And the Code Revisor's Office is sort of the official publication place for all of state government about where things are in the rulemaking process. And they have a number of forms that the department folks fill out to tell people where we are in this long process of adopting a rule. It starts with the filing of a proposed rule. And you've seen that. You heard a number of proposed rules yesterday. Then after that, there has to be an opportunity for written comment. There has to be an opportunity for an oral hearing. You normally hear your oral hearings. You could also delegate the power to either an individual member or the director. In that case, the director would hold the hearing, he would write a summary of the information provided to you, and you would go forward. You, when you're about to take action on a rule, you need to consider all of the information that has been gathered about this rulemaking. So you need to consider the comments you've heard, the recommendations from staff, and think about this stuff. when you adopt a rule, for the most part, unless you make a special finding, rules are not, do not become effective for 31 days. So there's a period for people, in the case they want to make a challenge before it becomes effective, they can do that. There are some standards about how much, how the breadth of ability you have to make changes from a proposed rule. And it sort of breaks out into three different groups. If they're very, very little technical changes, spelling changes, stuff like that, you can make those for free, basically. If they're beyond what the public would have expected when the public read the proposed rule, if they're sort of beyond a level of sort of closeness, then you need to do a new filing to update the proposed rule so the public can catch up and see what you're thinking about. The category that you often do is it's within the subject matter. It's changing 40 deer permits to 35 deer permits. And to me, that is, the public should have known that deer permits were at issue, and so you don't need to start all over. You can make those changes. When the department finishes your rulemaking process, that they need to file some extra explanations about those changes. And so sometimes they may need to come back to you about why, you know, you made this change. So when we make amendments and things like that, you know, it's important to sometimes signal why we're doing this. Permanent rules, most of the rules you adopt are permanent rules. They stay in effect until you change it. Unless the rule has some time limit that you put in it, it just stays as the law until you change it. So your hunting season rules, you know, they go until you change it. There are also emergency rules. You've delegated the ability to the director to adopt a number of kinds of emergency rules. Sometimes the staff come to you and say, we need an emergency rule for this purpose. And an emergency rule can be done on a faster timeline. It has less public comment. It can have less public comment process, and it can be put into effect in a quicker process, but it also has a number of limitations about it. This is the code revisor's diagram, simplified diagram, about the rulemaking process. You really come in the yellow star part. That's where, you know, the final decision's made. But I thought that, you know, these rules, it's a ton of work to go through the rulemaking process. So now that sort of concludes the rulemaking process. A little bit about public records. All of the things other than oral conversations that aren't recorded, all of the things that state government creates in any sort of tangible form, electronic records, tape recordings, photographs, music, anything that the state government creates becomes a public record, and there is a broad statement of legislative direction that the public should be able to see the public records that state agencies have. And so there's a record requesting system. And you have probably seen people who request records from the agency. The agency has a coordinator, and if we think you would have those records, we send notice to you that, hey, there's been a request for these records. Send them into the coordinator, and we'll, you know, figure out sort of what goes on. There are some exceptions to records that get disclosed. There are some reasons certain things need to be redacted. Some confidential information can either be redacted or not disclosed. But in general, this is another one of those very broad public service laws that say, in general, the records kept by the state, you know, should be reviewable by the public. And we'll provide a more detailed training in the future, because this is more complicated, and the penalties and the costs associated, and it's just gotten more and more and more complicated. And the Attorney General's office is really fortunate that my division chief, Joe, has really taken, on behalf of the Attorney General's office, a huge role in looking at electronic records and sort of all the process about that. And because of that, he's also become very experienced with regular public records, and we all, you know, spend time with him. So we can provide more training about that, but if there are questions, you know, don't hesitate to ask about them. So that, other than the ethics law, and we'll get to that at the end, that sort of, those are the how you get things done. The substantive law are sort of what it is you do using those tools. And the substantive law, for the most part, most of the statutes that you use to accomplish work are in Title 77. And they're in, this is what the revised Code of Washington looks like. There are eight or nine volumes, and they're just broken up into eight different shares, and in one of them is Title 77. Now, thankfully, the department has made a number, at least for their lawyers, the department has gathered 77, so I don't have to pack this and other ones around. But this is how big, you know, your statutory authority is. There are other laws that you apply, you know, whether you know it or not. The department applies SEPA for some of your transactions. There are, you know, a number of other laws that you touch. There are also federal laws. We do work with a number of treaties. Certainly Endangered Species Act at the federal level is something, you know, that you're pretty aware of. And being a coastal state, Marine Mammal Protection Act has been, you know, a very important thing that we've heard about. So there are a number of laws, but really Title 77 is the meat and potatoes, you know, toolbox that you do, that the department uses to get its work done, to interact with the public, to do things. So Title 77 has 26 chapters, and I won't go through all of them, but there's, at the beginning, there's a number of sort of overarching deals. There's how the commission is structured, who can be a commissioner, the role of the commissioner and the director. There's a general organization. There's the classification of wildlife into all the different subclassifications. Then there's chapters about licensing, all the different types of licensing. There's chapters a lot about fishing, because there's so many different types of fishing and fish resources. There's enforcement issues. There's habitat, salmon recovery, because there's so many different sort of entities that work in salmon recovery. There's the wildlife damage stuff. There's chapters on hatcheries, lands, other things. So just a really wide range of things. So that sort of is the toolbox you have. Now, these are sort of the things that I've seen you do. A lot of the hard work you do is rule adoption. You know, you see all the hunting rules, fishing rules. They're on a rotating cycle, and so they're always coming before you to set rules, you know, to provide opportunity or to restrict it as need be. You delegate certain authority to the director, and we're going to talk more about that in just a minute. One of the things you've delegated to the authority is the ability to deal with rulemaking on an emergency basis. So the director has the power to close a season, you know, if need be, on a really instantaneous basis, or open something. Rules are, I am an advocate, and I will recommend to you that rules be exact and clear. Your policies or your policies, they can be as vague as you want, but because rules are the law, and rules, particularly your rules, are criminally enforceable in a lot of cases, they provide opportunities that need to be, because your fishing, your hunting is so complicated, you need to be very clear as to what opportunity you're providing somebody. So I often encourage you, when I see sort of vagueness, that we be very clear, you know, in what these rules are. Rules, in general, your statutes provide that once you have a quorum of people attending a meeting, you can transact most of your business by the majority vote of a quorum. You have a different statute that talks about your ability to adopt rules, and my belief is it says that you need 5 affirmative votes to pass a rule. So a different voting structure. Rules, I think, require a higher level of votes to pass. Your rules are contained, this is a little bit of a historical basis, but your rules are contained in the Washington Administrative Code. It's a different color set of volumes like this. Your rules are in 2 chapters. They go back to the old historic 2 different agencies, but it's just that we've never smashed them together. So when it's fishing rules, when it's some marine fishing issue, you'll hear, hey, we're amending WAC 220, 35, blah, blah, blah. Like the crab rule was 220, it's in chapter 56, and it was rule 330. Because there, it's a shellfish rule, it goes back to that historic Department of Fisheries thing. The wildlife rules and the hunting rules, all that, are in Title 232. So all the hunting stuff, 232, you know, blah, 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 blah.
Commissioner Perry?
Thank you. There was one thing that back a slide or two, slide 22, at the bottom there, it says voting, five affirmative votes. And then there, the bullet under that is other actions need a majority of a quorum, which will only be three. Could you go into a little more detail on that?
Sure. For instance, the commission, as I remember, you were down to five or six members for a while. And you need five members to have an official meeting. So, for instance, let's say you remember you were down to five members. There weren't appointments in those other seats. In my mind, you have two transactions on one of those days in front of you, a land transaction and a rule adoption. So if you only had five members there, I would tell you, I believe your authority says to pass the rule, you have to have five affirmative votes. To pass the land transaction, the vote could be 4-1.
I see.
3-2.
Okay, thank you.
Other commission actions you do that the statutes provide, you have a role in the budget and legislative process of the department. You can adopt policies. You have the statutory authority to appoint the director and to review his performance. There are a number of other statutory specific duties that the commission has. You have a role in appointing the committee. I can't remember their exact name right now, but you meet with the governor. That's pointed out by statute. You make the land transactions. Other things you do. You have your business practices, and those are things you do, and then the delegation of authority thing. So that sort of concludes what I see as your substantive sort of law and duty. And now I was going to finish up with one more sort of process deal, which is the ethics in public service law. And this law, I did separately. I did at the end. It has another very, very overarching legislative declaration about the importance of serving the public when you're serving as a government official. Ethics are the foundation of good government. There's a special trust, and you have a very high obligation for honesty and integrity. The citizens should expect the highest ethical behavior of you. Very liberal, very high statement. This is particularly important in my mind for a number of reasons. One, first, it's the law. That's a good reason. Public interest and media scrutiny. We see these things come in the newspaper every once in a while, and whether if you've complied with the law, but it's still one of these questionable ones. The media just loves this stuff, so it's something to think about. This act, different than the other ones, this act applies to you personally. And so there is a higher level of sort of your personal interest in complying. If there was an allegation of ethical impropriety, there is an executive ethics board, and they are the ones that a person could make a complaint to. And they would look at the complaint and decide, is there, they make a first cut at it. Is this something we should look into, or given the nature of the complaint, is this just, a gripe or something that doesn't really merit an investigation? If it did merit an investigation, then they would start to, look into what's going on. At that role, the role of the Attorney General's office, the Executive Ethics Board, is inside the Attorney General's office. And so it is the Attorney General's office view that we then take, your normal, agency counselor, We take a different role if you are the subject of an ethics investigation. We would not provide you, because this is personal to you, we would not provide you narrow sort of personal legal advice in the sense that we might with the Open Public Meetings Act. We would look at the commission as a whole and help the commission as a whole decide, does the commission as a whole have an interest in this question? And rarely a commission might. More often than not, you know, this is a personal matter. So this one is something to, you know, as long as, you know, you're aware of the ethical standards, it's very, very rarely an issue. But it is something I wanted to impress upon you. This one is you know, real. So I put it at the end. The good news about this is the Executive Ethics Board is very, very user-friendly. And so if there's a question you have about the Ethics Act, rather than bring it to me, I encourage you to go to them because they are the policemen of this law and they want to work through issues ahead of time with you. So this is one where it's very, very, very much better to ask for information than forgiveness. So they can issue very low-key, informal advice to you. They have this process where they will issue advisory opinions, and a commissioner in the past had a question about his ability to participate in a commercial fishery and was concerned about the conflict sort of issues. And so there's an advisory opinion back there talking about, you know, the role of the Fish and Wildlife Commission, how you get on it, looking at those statutes, and then looking at this commissioner's individual case and their published opinion. So it's out there, and that commissioner could then rely on that opinion. So I really encourage you, take advantage of these resources. You know, it's there to help you and stay ahead of problems. And the department also has a person who provides ethics training to department staff, and so they may have people who are, you know, more involved in ethics issues than I am. But we'll go through. The Ethics Act tries to take the ethics, you know, sort of the vague amorphous idea of ethics, and capture it in statutory provisions. The Act establishes the minimums, so you can always behave more ethically than you know, some of these things we go through, but these are the minimums. It is sort of broken out into five ethical principles: objectivity, selflessness, stewardship, transparency, and integrity. And more of the ones are sort of front-loaded at the top. Objectivity, state officers, and you guys are state officers. The Act defines state officers and state employees. Both the provisions apply to everybody, but you aren't necessarily an employee, but it does pick you up in the definition of state officer. So state officers must place the public's interest before any private interest or obligation. That's the highest level of thing to think about in doing your work, your government work. You may not have a financial interest or engage in activity that's in conflict with the proper discharge of your Fish and Wildlife Commission duties. Now, this is on a, you know, it's not, there are times where you have your personal life, you know, and you can do things. This doesn't prevent you from having a personal life. It's just that you need to, you know, be aware of your obligation as a Fish and Wildlife Commissioner. So some of the specifics. You can't have a financial interest, a personal financial interest, or a business financial interest in something that comes before you. These are general rules. Now, there's a specific rule that we'll come to that does provide some exceptions in certain cases where the legislature has said these are the legislative rules. Now, sometimes these rules get in conflict with other things the legislature said, and I'll show you how that happens in a minute. But in general, all state officers can't be decision makers of, like, their own land transactions. So you can't buy, in the government sense, land you're selling as a private person.
Commissioner Carpenter?
I don't think my question's out. It may be out of context a little bit, Bill, but I come from the private sector. You know what I do. And I have in my business, I have done work for state agencies, federal agencies, for decades. I just want to make sure that I avoid any potential conflict there as it relates to this discussion. If I need to know something more about it, then tell me so.
Yeah, let me show you how the legislature has provided for your circumstance. You can't assist in something you couldn't do directly also. And you can't receive compensation for something related to one of these. So you can't be behind the scenes fostering one of these things. So in the commission statutes, it says the governor is to appoint 9 commissioners, and those commissioners are to have certain qualifications. They're to come from a broad range of interests in the fish and wildlife community, including it could be commercial fishers, the commercial fishing interests, things like that. So the governor, in finding you commissioners, may pick people who have business interests or personal interests or other interests that may really run directly in conflict with some of these fundamental, you know, interests and transactions. And so the legislature in the Ethics Act has provided that these general rules don't apply in the narrow circumstance that the legislature in another place has said a commissioner needs to be from one of these interest groups or things. So, for instance, a number of other commissions have people, you have to have a doctor, you have to have a nurse, you have to have this, you have to have a person from labor, you have to have a person from that. And so they're more specific than your situations, and they were running into these, hey, I got to be a doctor, but how can I, you know, not have these conflicts? So in the Ethics Act, it says if the legislature in another place has provided that you need to be this type of person, that's an exception to the general rule. So that's how they work through this.
Commissioner Mencken?
Larry Carpenter sells boats. The department is involved in boat ramps and the management of boat ramps and installation therein. Although Larry Carpenter would have no financial gain from making a decision with regard to a boat ramp, could he or should he recuse himself?
Well, I think that I think I'm not prepared to answer that question right now. I think I can get a better sense of exactly what the question is. I think if there are, I really encourage anybody who has ethics questions to talk with the executive director of the ethics board, because they are the experts. They are the people who apply this law. So if we want to create a question, create a scenario of likely, you know, circumstances, we can send it to them. Either you can send it to them directly or you can have me send it to them. But I really encourage you getting the information from the source in this case. Because if I advise you wrongly, you are the one who are going to be investigated if there's an issue, and I'm not going to be there to help you.
Yeah, and we have organized sessions with representatives. We had, the director of the Ethics Board a few years ago, and it was of less utility than it might have been if we planned ahead a little bit better, I think, in setting up some examples that are relevant to the commission. So if you'd like, we can just work on coming up with a more detailed session that would be really tailored to the exact likely scenarios.
Yeah, either
and get someone from the
either
ethics
a session board. Or one-on-one consultation or small group, you know,
yeah.
However you want to do it.
I don't mean to, you know, intimate that Larry's been involved in anything of that sort. I think that's a good example of something that would be borderline at best.
Commissioner Schmitten?
Thank you, Chair. This is really helpful. This may sound like common sense, and I should have the answer, but I'd sure like to hear it. There is no specific statutory authority for Fish and Wildlife Commissioners to be selected from a various sector of Fish and Wildlife. My understanding, it was simply to have a knowledge of Fish and Wildlife or have participated in Fish and Wildlife management in some way. So I get, the question is, do you need a recreational individual? Do you need a commercial individual? Do you need a conservation individual? There is no specific requirements that I understand apply.
Correct. That's my reading of the statute also. Your statute provides a very wide range of interests that you may have. The governor is to find people who have general knowledge, you know, of the natural resource, of the different parts of it, but other commissions have very narrow, limited seats, and so there's a labor seat, there's a business seat, there's a small business seat. Yours is not like that. Yours is very, very flexible within sort of the general knowledge base of fish and wildlife and fish and wildlife interests.
Commissioner Duvia.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I think I'm okay, but maybe I want to confess my sins. I'm not sure if I'm in the right place or not, but as you know, we've closed the Colville Hatchery, and I've been working to try to transfer our share or come up with arrangements where the community college and other entities lease or buy the Colville Hatchery from the department. And because of my financial background and my relationships with the community colleges, I'm formulating the business plan to make this work. Am I in conflict? There's no monetary benefit to me. There's probably a negative monetary conflict for me, but am I on thin ice there? Because...
Yeah, like I say, I mean, I'm happy. I really encourage narrow and general questions on this act to go to the true source. I'm happy to help frame those questions, and there's no penalty. I mean, this is a great public resource, that the ability to go to the interpreter of the act, basically, and get the information. I'm happy to help, frame a question or look into it in more detail. I'm not prepared now to answer, I guess, or I'm sure I'm not prepared right now to answer. but I'm happy to, continue discussion about it.
Okay, great.
So the second of these big ethics principles is selflessness. You are not to make decisions in order to gain financially or receive other benefits for your interests, yourselves, your family. Pretty, I don't think this comes up very often. I can't think of times where you might use your state position for special privileges, but you should not use your state position for special privileges. So if you are pulled over by a traffic officer, I wouldn't tell them that, they should let you go simply because you're a Fish and Wildlife officer or you're a Fish and Wildlife Commissioner.
Madam Chair.
Oh, sorry. Commissioner Jennings.
But special privileges is sort of an undefined term. As an example, a couple years back when we were looking at the crab rule, I asked and got permission to go out for a couple days on the water with our enforcement officers. Many people would have looked at that as that's kind of a nice, opportunity. I didn't see it as a special privilege. I saw it as part of information gathering to make a better decision. So are there any definitions around special privileges?
There may be. I can't remember them right now. I'm happy to look at that more or talk about that. I think in that case there's a continuum. The Ethics Act the Ethics Act is a reasonable thing. It does not anticipate every possible thing and provide a clear answer. I think there are some things that you can take advantage of in learning to be a good commissioner, an educated commissioner, in order to do your business as a commissioner. And that sounds to me like something that is probably, right in in line with that. There was another circumstance. You know, let's say that you were a recreational fisher also, but a guide said, or a number of guides said, you know, hey, come with me 10 times, you know, to go recreational fishing so that you have a better appreciation of recreational fishing. Well, at some point, I think that is a different place on a continuum. You know, so I don't think there are exact bright lines. A lot of it is common sense. A lot of it is being aware, you know, of sort of these high ethical standards. You know, how does it look? How would this be portrayed in the newspaper? So I think those are different, you know, probably different places on a continuum. Gifts. A commissioner may not receive anything of economic value as a gift if it could reasonably be expected to influence the performance or non-performance of the officer's duties. I don't think this is something that happens very often, but gifts are, under the Ethics Act, it created two categories of state agencies. One that doesn't regulate people, basically. They do other things. I don't know what they do, but the other is called Section 4. And for Section 4, those are agencies that regulate people or have direct relations with people who, you know, run into these things. And in Section 4, they created very, very strict limits as to gifts. And when this law was being worked on, I mean, there were views of the public in which accepting a cup of coffee was, you know, it was that level of gift that some members of the public believed, you know, needed to be prohibited because the cup of coffee was the thing, you know, anything. It was, you couldn't do anything. The act in Section 4, it does provide very high standard of things you can't accept, basically. And so it wants to keep you pure. Things that are not gifts, items from your family, friends, when it's clear beyond a reasonable part, it wasn't designed. So you can still have holidays. You can go to the birthday party.
Birthday parties, Commissioner Mankin?
Yeah, so your personal life, you know, the Ethics Act does not change your personal life. It does change, you know, your commissioner life. You know, so these things, social events, you know, if your team wins the bowling league, you know, you can have your name inscribed on there. Section 4, these apply to regulators, and you are basically a regulator. The department has chosen to apply these rules to all of its staff. I think that you should consider the same thing because you regulate, you know, I mean, most of the rules you adopt are regulatory. So, you can receive things of nominal value, pens, notepaper, small awards, tokens, little things, food and beverages. If you're standing up when you eat it, you know, and it comes on the teeny little plates, you know, and you're not using, you know, it, I mean, it got into this level of stuff. You may not accept flowers. You know, how did this stuff get in? Flowers. But this is in statute. Valuable gifts, food and beverages when a meal. You know, so if you go to a group and they want to provide you lunch, it would be best to say, I'll pay for my own lunch. Let's go get lunch. I'll pay for mine. You pay for yours. Things like that. Other reasonable expenses. Most gifts, even of less than $50 in value, gifts are just trouble. I don't know how often it happens, but, you know, be very aware. Another one of these ethical principles is stewardship. You have a duty to conserve public resources and guard against misuse of public resources. So this is using the state car. This is using the printer, using the phone, using, you know, all the state resources. High standards, you know, don't use this stuff, you know, for your own personal life. You're given a privilege to use these resources in your role as commissioner. Leave it at that. okay, you can't use state resources for your own personal thing. The general rule is you can't do it. There are some narrow exceptions of really, really small time uses. But there, at the other end, there are some strict things which it's like even a higher burden. You absolutely can't use a state resource in your private business. You can't use it for a commercial purpose, and you can't use it in your own personal political advocacy or interest, things like that. So these are the highest sort of evils. Transparency. The Ethics Act is another place where the legislature has said agencies need to, and government employees need to, act in open and publicly accessible ways. It ties to other statutes, but what this does is, you know, it brings a penalty scheme from the Ethics Act to some of these other laws. So it beefs up the penalties in some of these things. I don't think these are, you know, things that you run into, but I thought I'd go through it all. Confidential information, the commission acts as a body. You know, you're individual commissioners, but the commission takes action as a body. Information you get individually is the information of the commission. You know, so there is a corporate entity, you know, and you need to think about that. So it would be inappropriate for commissioners to disclose the inner workings of the commission, you know, things like that.
Commissioner Perry?
Thank you. Here a couple of years ago, we had an incident where there was confidential information delivered in an executive session. And we found that in a very short time, probably a day or even less than a day, that it became public. Is there penalties for that? Somebody violated the confidentiality. This was several years ago. And like I say, is there penalties for that? How is that handled?
I think that for the most part, the Ethics Act is enforced through complaints filed to the Ethics Board. So if someone was offended by, you know, behavior, they could file a complaint with the Ethics Board. They would begin an investigation of it. I don't know that the Ethics Board has the staff or the capability to go out and sort of look for trouble, look for violations, you know, and then as a government body, you know, the Ethics Act provides a set of standards that would be applied in that circumstance to judge whether was there a violation or not. If an entity didn't go and trigger sort of the Ethics Act, you as a body can say that's you know, not appropriate behavior. Your ability to enforce, you know, other than using the Ethics Act, I'm not sure sort of how you enforce good behavior, you know, other than using the tools. And the tools I can think of are the Ethics Act. Integrity, I think, is the last one of my ethical deals, and public officers should not place themselves under any obligation to individuals or organizations that might influence, you know. So you are representing the interests of the public as a whole. That's how you should think in general. There are the narrow exceptions where, you know, you were put on the commission or any commission because of your certain interest, and you know, and you bring that. And so there's a mix. But in general, you know, you to have high goals and aspirations here. You can't receive compensation other than for your official duties other than the, you know, compensation you receive. So don't get paid to do this by someone else. And that sort of concludes the you know, big picture.
Okay. In a nutshell.
In a nutshell, yeah.
Lots more detail if you'd like. Thanks very much. Great job. I think we asked enough questions as you were going along.